From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The 10 Worst Corporations of 1996.
Corporate crime and violence inflicts far more damage on society than all street crime combined. For example, the FBI estimates that burglary and robbery in 95 cost the nation $4 billion a year. But very conservative estimates put the impact of corporate crime and violence at $200 billion a year. So why is it then when during political campaigns all we hear about is street crime?
And a look at the controversial Guatemalan peace accord. We'll talk with two leading opponents of the Guatemalan regime, Frank LaRue and Jennifer Harbury. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. This news from the front page of the Washington Post today. More than 150,000 workers in South Korea went on strike today, and as many as 1.2 million more plan to join them for a one-day work stoppage today to protest labor laws enacted by President Kim Young-sam's ruling party during a clandestine pre-dawn session of the National Assembly. Today's strike idled more than 100 major South Korean companies, including the nation's leading automaker, Hyundai Motor Corporation, and the world's largest shipyard. Today's 24-hour strike will affect hospitals, subways, and about 5,000 other South Korean businesses, bringing the nation's frenetic export-led economy to a virtual standstill. The new labor laws allowing layoffs and replacements for striking workers, as well as 10 other bills, were passed without debate during a six-minute session of the National Assembly that began at 6 this morning. The only legislators present were 155 members of the ruling New Korea Party, who gathered secretly at four Seoul hotels and drove to the assembly building in hired buses. Furious labor leaders who shaved their heads to protest the legislation began a sit-in today in a tent outside a Seoul cathedral. Opposition legislators threatened a similar sit-down protest at the National Assembly. They joined labor leaders in criticizing Kim's government for staging what they called a legislative coup d'etat under cover of darkness. And this latest news that just came over the wire around South Korea, the biggest shock was a decision by the normally docile Federation of Korean Trade Unions to confront the government over the passage of the tough new labor laws. It announced that a strike planned for just 24 hours starting today at noon would be extended until the end of the year and possibly beyond that. And a Thai businesswoman who's a major donor to the Democratic Party brought five business associates to a White House coffee with President Clinton the same day she and a relative gave $135,000 to the Democratic National Committee. The business associates brought to the White House by the donor, Pauline Kanchanalak, included three top officials of a Thai business conglomerate with extensive interests in China. The primary topic of conversation at the hour-long June 18th session was U.S. policy in China, according to one participant invited by Kanchanalak, Carl Jackson of the U.S.-Thai Business Council. DNC Press Secretary Amy Weiss-Tobe said the coffee was also attended by DNC Chair Donald Fowler, Finance Chair Marvin Rosen, and fundraiser John Huang, who was responsible for encouraging contributors in the Asian American community and who had ties to the Thai contributor dating to his time as a Commerce Department official. The Reverend Jesse Jackson will meet with Oakland school officials after softening his position on the district's plan to incorporate Black English, or Ebonics, into its curriculum. Jackson said in a telephone interview from his Chicago home, "Reaching out to find our youth where they are and building a bridge is the thing to do." Jackson planned to meet with Oakland school officials on Monday. Last week, he harshly criticized the school board's decision to recognize Black English, saying the district shouldn't be teaching students to talk garbage. In this international news, Burma's capital was rocked by twin bombings that killed five at a shrine. The military regime blamed student and ethnic Karen insurgents based in eastern Burma and said foreign elements had given them training. The two devices, apparently timed to cause maximum damage, went off at a Rangoon temple holding a tooth believed to have belonged to Buddha. The relic, on loan from China, has drawn large crowds, including many Burmese officials. Peruvian guerrillas freed Guatemala's ambassador from the residence of the Japanese ambassador in Lima, where they continued to hold 103 hostages captured more than a week ago. Earlier, a rebel booby trap went off accidentally, causing a blast that frayed nerves further in the 10-day-old standoff. And this news from the Wall Street Journal's Washington Wire, a special weekly report from the journal's Capitol Bureau. Some Republicans are waffling on keeping Newt Gingrich as House Speaker. Holdouts include fellow Georgia Congressmember Collins, who wants the penalty phase of Gingrich's ethics case settled first. Conservative Paul Weyrich says activists out in the countryside fear that Gingrich, tainted by charges of misleading Congress and using tax-exempt funds for politics, might be too weak to push their agenda. Democrats seek to sow more doubts and block further action before the House elects a speaker January 7th. They circulate documents indicating that Gingrich's staff was warned. A lawyer's 1990 letter noted an express prohibition on the political use of tax-exempt groups and recommended against doing so. Gingrich's office says there's no indication the speaker ever saw the letter. And this also from the Wall Street Journal. Don't call us. The GOP gets back at Democratic corporate givers. One obvious target for revenge is Seagram. The liquor company and top executives gave $1.2 million to Democrats over the past 2 years, nearly twice their GOP giving. When regulators threatened to fight plans for TV liquor ads, Seagram came running to us saying, save us, says a GOP congressional staffer. Republicans turned a cold shoulder. And automakers fear President Clinton will toughen emission and fuel economy rules. After kid gloves treatment the past 4 years, industry officials predict Vice President Al Gore will make the environment a priority as he prepares to run in 2000. They cite a Clinton speech in Australia where he called cars a source of harmful greenhouse gas emissions. Environmentalists are pushing for tougher emission controls and a global warming treaty, but they aren't convinced Clinton will take significant steps. State Department negotiators say they don't think target levels of emissions should be set until 2010. Environmentalists want a 2005 target date, or, says one, people aren't going to take this very seriously. Two Marine generals emerge as the leading candidates to succeed Joint Chiefs Chair John Shalikashvili next year. Anthony Zinni, a veteran of northern Iraq now at the U.S. Central Command, and John Sheehan, chief of the U.S. Atlantic Command. A Marine has never held the Joint Chiefs slot. President Clinton is considering again suspending an anti-Cuba trade provision. Tougher rhetoric against Cuba by Europe, which opposes the provision, gives the president some political cover. A decision isn't expected until mid-January. But White House officials say Clinton is leaning toward a second suspension of the Helms-Burton provisions that would allow Cuban Americans to sue foreign firms that, quote, traffic in their expropriated property in Cuba. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today, we're going to take a look at the top 10 corporations that have been named by the multinational monitor as the worst of 1996. The FBI reports that corporate crime costs the country more than $200 billion a year, or 50 times as much burglary and robbery combined, and more than twice the number of people die from job-related causes than homicide. We're joined now by Russell McIver, editor of the Washington, D.C.-based Corporate Crime Reporter, a weekly newsletter on white-collar crime. And we're joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez, a columnist for the New York Daily News. First, welcome, Juan.
Thank you, Amy, and happy holidays to everyone out there.
Happy holidays to you. Any resolutions?
Not yet. I'm going to work on them this weekend.
Okay, yes. I'll check up on you next week. And welcome, Russell McIver.
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, Juan.
Well, why don't we start, morning, Russell. Why don't we start by, rather than you listing the corporations at the beginning, though I want to get to all 10 that you've named, why don't we start out the way you started out your piece in the Multinational Monitor, by talking about this commission that is being set up by the Pew Charitable Trust.
Yes, Amy, the Pew Charitable Trusts have given $1 million to start the National Commission on Civic Renewal. It's headed by the Heritage Foundation's William Bennett and former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn. They will hold three meetings here in Washington, closed to the public but apparently open to the press. And the commissioners will discuss the nature and extent of America's moral decline and ways to renew civic activism. Now, Bennett has talked about the problems inherent in unbridled capitalism, although he says that he knows that every time he talks about unbridled capitalism, he will hear from his funders, which generally are large American Fortune 500 corporations, both to the Heritage Foundation and to his other group, Empower America. But at the press conference announcing this commission, he said that America leads the world in rates of murder, violent crime, juvenile crime, imprisonment, abortion, pornography, and so on and so forth. He failed to address the issue of corporate crime and violence, which inflicts far more damage on society than all street crime combined. And we are urging the commission to seriously look at citizen activists who are seeking to reclaim the corporate realm, the public realm, for workers and consumers and the environment. Unfortunately, we think that the commission is stacked and that the commission will focus on street crime and street violence and moral decay among individuals and not look at moral decay from the corporate sector.
But Russell, when you say that corporate crime inflicts far more damage than, let's say, street crime in America, the average American may say to you, well, look, I have to confront street crime on a daily basis. Corporate crime is, or white-collar crime is something up there in the stratosphere that doesn't directly affect me. How do you respond to that?
Well, Juan, it'd be difficult to make that case this week to the families of eight workers who were killed at a blast at a defense contractor in Houston, Texas, Wyman Gordon. This is a very serious accident, a huge explosion, threw workers all over the place, killed eight, injured two seriously. Those are the last numbers we have. Unfortunately, we don't have details about exactly what happened in the history of the company here, but we're going to be looking into it. It's very important that the government take this serious. Even Secretary Rush, as good as he's been on these issues, has not had a tough law enforcement program for criminally prosecuting companies that engage in reckless workplace activities that result in death to workers. You know, Juan, if you look at just homicides, the FBI puts it at about 24,000 a year. But deaths on the job in America and occupational illnesses take 56,000 Americans a year. That's almost twice as much. And so we have just on the numbers, we have a serious problem. The reason, of course, is the perception problem. If you look at all the crime shows, if you look at TV, and Americans are glued to their TVs more than ever now, people are being freaked out because the focus of TV news and crime and violence shows is on street crime. The focus is not on corporate crime and violence. If it were, people would be justifiably concerned about corporate crime and violence. Now, the other point here is...
Let me just say, I mean, I would agree with you completely. I was just playing devil's advocate there because I know editors at many of the mainstream papers would say precisely what I've said to you, because when, for instance, you're not going to find, I have yet to see one show on television that portrays an OSHA inspector as the hero and his daily battles going from plant to plant trying to find to protect the workers. But yes, you will have 30 shows a week with the cop as the hero.
Well, maybe Juan and Russell, you're going to have to just go into business and produce one.
Well, the media question is really important. Here's one example. Earlier this month, a corporate crime reporter, we ran an article based on information we got from OSHA, showing that one company's stone container, there had been 18 worker deaths over the past 12 years. And these were gruesome deaths. It's not like TV wouldn't be interested in this, workers being ripped to shreds by machinery and so forth. Now, this was real news. This is information that other newspapers did not have. This is stuff that we got from inside OSHA that was leaked to us. And I took this information to all the major news outlets, and no one touched it. So it's a question of perspective. I mean, if your focus is going to be on corporate on street crime and violence, then you're not gonna be looking for these kinds of stories.
Well, why don't we go to your list, Russell? This is the list that's appearing in the December issue of the Multinational Monitor, the 10 Worst Corporations of 1996. You begin with ADM, super racket to the world, as you put it.
Yes, and also sponsors of many shows on national public radio, including
I haven't been seeing
Edition.
Them on that much lately.
including Morning Edition and All Things Considered. No, they're still sponsoring the shows, and this was a very egregious crime. In fact, Duane Andreas, the CEO of ADM and the man who has passed out millions of dollars to political parties and candidates to inoculate himself from this kind of criticism, went before his shareholders in October and said that he deeply regretted this crime. He took responsibility and he apologized on behalf of the company for these antitrust crimes. Now, these antitrust crimes, basically price fixing, cost consumers hundreds of millions of dollars. And shareholder activist groups who are active within ADM and who know what's going on in the company believe that the Clinton Justice Department pulled its punches in bringing a criminal charge against the company, but in effect granting immunity to Duane Andreas and everybody within the company in exchange for cooperation except for two executives. And so there's a real question as to the fairness of this prosecution to shareholders and to a sense of justice. And a gentleman named David Hake, who runs a shareholder activist group in Hallandale, Florida, has a lot of information on this, and he's going to continue to push until justice is brought against the executives at ADM.
Well, for the consumers who may have missed the news on why they got this $100 million fine, what precisely was the crime that affected the average everyday person in terms of their price fixing?
Well, they went to the they basically met with their competitors and decided what the price on lysine, which is an amino acid, and citric acid, which are used as feedstuffs in agriculture, will be. Instead of letting the market determine the price, which would have been a much lower price, they got together. It's an oligopoly. A few number of companies control the market and said, this is what the market will be. Now, this goes on all the time in corporate America. It's like the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. We don't know who's controlling, but when you pull back the curtain, there's a guy, you know, with buttons and bells calling the shots. Now,
so when you go to the supermarket and Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola and every other brand just happens to have the same price for that 2-liter bottle, that just didn't happen by accident.
Right, but it wasn't price fixing at that level. It was price fixing at the level of the citric acid and the lysine, which affected the market where all those products go. Mm-hmm. But the thing that's interesting here is that none of this would have been made public were it not for Mark Whitaker, who is a former high executive at ADM, and the FBI went to him and said, "Will you wear a wire for 2 years?" And he said, "Yes." And basically tape recorded all these conversations of these executives committing crimes. And then when Whitaker started pointing at other directions where he thought the FBI and the Justice Department should go, and the FBI and the Justice Department didn't want to go, there was a falling out. And the Justice Department is now going after Whitaker for Whitaker's alleged crimes. Now, I think Whitaker's got a lot more to say that could bring a lot of trouble to ADM, and his what he has to say is being watched very closely. He has sued ADM for libel, and that case is proceeding.
Russell, just very quickly, because you have nine more to go, and I know we won't get to all of them, but in a minute we're going to be talking about the Guatemala Peace Accords, and one of the corporations that you cite is Gerber.
Right. This is an interesting situation that has to do with the World Trade Agreement and GATT and so forth. You know, Gerber's famous baby slogan is on most of its products, and women activists believe that this encourages women to this cute little baby and promotions by Gerber to bottle feed instead of breastfeed encourages women to stop breastfeeding and purchase their products. So the government of Guatemala passed a very tough law prohibiting these kind of images on foods and baby foods. And Gerber went in using the threat of trade sanctions and forced the government of Guatemala to change its policy. A citizen activist in the United States, Leah Margolis, in New York City, has a lot of information on this, and she documented it, and we based our story on her documentation of this.
We're talking to Russell McIver. He is editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter and has listed the 10 worst corporations of 1996 in the Multinational Monitor. We'll continue with the list. We have a few more minutes with him, and then we're going to talk about the controversial Guatemalan peace accord that's expected to be signed on Sunday. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we're joined by Russell McIver, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, who's come up with his top 10 list, or should I say the worst 10, that's the corporations of 1996, that he feels have committed the worst crimes.
Well, Russell, two of the most well-known that you have on there, I notice, are Texaco and the Disney Company. And before you tell us a little bit about them, although we've heard quite a bit about them in recent months, I note in your article that one of the members of this new commission on civic renewal is John F. Cook, the executive vice president for corporate affairs for the Walt Disney Company. So I'm glad to see that Mickey Mouse is involved in the moral analysis in our society right now. But could you tell us why you chose Disney and Texaco in your top 10?
Right. For Disney, this raises the question for us of whether Mickey Mouse is really a rat, as Charlie Kernaghan puts it. Charles Kernaghan is a citizen activist that we are urging the Commission on Civic Renewal to call to testify about how citizens and consumers can become civically active and challenge corporate wrongdoing and in that way reclaim the marketplace. Now, Kernaghan points out that Disney produces Pocahontas pajamas and Disney wares in Haiti, and that Haitian workers don't make a living wage. Now, the workers in Haiti just want to meet with Disney. They've been calling for a meeting for over a year to talk about this problem of a living wage. They say they would be happy with 58 cents an hour. the workers in Disney say this, the workers who are making these Disney wares, and Disney refuses to meet with them. Now, we think there's a big problem with the Commission on Civic Renewal, because here we have Charlie Kernaghan, who's been organizing in the United States. He tours workers from Central America and Haiti throughout the United States, talking to American citizens. American citizens are becoming active, boycotting Disney, not going to see 101 Dalmatians, boycotting Disney movies and Disney products. And so there's real civic activity. There's a civic renewal going on, and we think that Charlie Kernaghan should testify before the commission and present this as a way to get Americans from out from their living rooms, to turn off the TV, to make them civically active, and to ensure that corporations are held accountable.
And, of course, Texaco you have on here also?
Yeah, well, of course, Texaco is well known. Again, a lot of this was a lot of corporate crime, violence, and wrongdoing happens behind closed doors, and we don't hear about it. My guess is that we only hear about 5% of what happens. And the reason, again, we heard about this is because a former Texaco executive rolled a tape recorder, because it was his job to document what was going on. And the executives were talking about a lawsuit where minority employees had sued the company. And the executives start talking derogatorily about minority employees and talking about how that documents should be destroyed and how they were planning on destroying the documents so the lawyers for the minority employees wouldn't get their hands on it. And when this executive was laid off in a downsizing, he made his tape public, and it created this huge uproar. Texaco was forced to the bargaining table. The CEO, made statements saying that he apologized and this was wrong and that was wrong, and they paid a settlement amount and so forth. But the real question is, has anybody learned anything here? We don't think so. For example, a major law firm in New York, Winston & Strawn, put out a memo titled The Lessons of Texaco. And they came up with, and we found this after we wrote, this isn't in the article, we found this after the issue went to print. And here were the lessons that he came up with. And this is a high-ranking lawyer in a top-ranked corporate law firm in New York City, Winston & Strawn. He said, one, prohibit employees from taping conversations. Two, quote, there is nothing inherently illegal about routinely shredding documents. Three, put a lawyer in meetings so you can claim attorney-client privilege and hide everything. And four, offer money to the whistleblower so that they agree not to say anything. Well, okay, that's the lesson. That's the lesson of illegal discrimination. No, as one law professor at NYU, Monroe Friedman, put it, the lesson of this is don't discriminate. Not to destroy documents and not tape things and not get the information out. But the corporate world's not learning, and that's because citizens haven't become that active yet.
Leslie, you've got three Japanese corporations, Daishawa, Daiwa Bank Limited, and Mitsubishi, on this list. Is this a new thing now, that the rise of Japanese corporations on an American list of corporate vultures here, and especially Mitsubishi? You mentioned the boycott against them, the worldwide boycott. If you could explain a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, Juan, I'm not sure if you did. Did you folks do a story on the Institute for Policy Studies list of major economies? And some of them are like the United States and China and so forth, but others are major U.S. and Japanese corporations. So, yes, Japanese multinationals are major players, and they do engage in wrongdoing. Daiwa, of course, was criminally convicted, and the U.S. attorney in New York said this was corporate crime at its worst.
What did they do?
Well, it was basically, selling off securities that were held in trust without telling customers about it, and it cost consumers $1 billion. But also Mitsubishi, there's an ongoing, and again, we call on William Bennett to invite the citizen activists who are calling for a boycott of Mitsubishi's products to testify before his commission on civic renewal instead of just having corporate types there. Bring in some citizen activists. I mean, here's a company that's been destroying rainforests around the world, that's been accused by the EEOC of engaging in sexual harassment at a facility in the Midwest, and there's a very active ongoing boycott of its products, including Nikon cameras, Kirin beer, Value Rent-A-Car, and the Bank of California. And these are primarily young people at universities around the country saying this is a major world multinational corporation that's engaging in wrongdoing around the world, and they have a list of everything that's going on, and saying consumers shouldn't be buying these products. And we agree with them, and we're trying to bring attention to this kind of wrongdoing.
And finally, you've got Seagram's on there.
Well, yeah. I mean, in the last 10 years, we've seen an increase in young people drinking hard liquor and alcohol. And for the last 50 years, the liquor industry has had a voluntary ban on advertising, broadcast advertising of liquor. And we think that one reason. And Seagram's took a lead and said, "Listen, we're going to start advertising again." And in response, the whole industry said, "We're going to start advertising again." And the real result is going to be more alcohol related car crashes with young people, and people are going to die as a result of this. This is a totally irresponsible action, and they should reverse their stand. Even the corporatist president Bill Clinton has come out and said that the industry is doing the wrong thing here and should reverse its stand.
Well, Russell McIver, we want to thank you very much for joining us, and we'd like to get some numbers, both of the Multinational Monitor, where your top 10 list ran, your 10 worst corporations of 1996, and then of the Corporate Crime Reporter. Multinational
okay.
Monitor.
If you want to subscribe to Multinational Monitor, it's $20 a year, and you can send a check to Multinational Monitor, P.O. Box 19405, Washington, D.C., 20036, and they have a website at www.essential.org. And then for Corporate Crime Reporter, you can write us at Corporate Crime Reporter, P.O. Box 18384, Washington, D.C., 20036.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And again, that top 10 list, ADM, Caterpillar for union busting, how do you pronounce it, Daishoa?
Daishoa,
Daiwa, Disney, Freeport-McMoRan for their abuses in Indonesia, Gerber, Mitsubishi, Seagram's, and Texaco. Thanks very much for being with us, Russell.
Thank you.
Again, Russell McIver, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter.
My, my, my. How time flies. My, my, my.
On Tuesday, December 31st, we'll be bringing you a year's look back at 1996, so we do hope you tune in. And we hope you'll call us so you can be included in that year-end wrap-up with the most significant events of the year, according to you.
Possible to go back in time. Now we can assume that.
My, my, my.
The number to call to leave your message is 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313.
Who speaks for the future?
The future just keeps coming at you.
It's 1996. Here comes the millennium.
And from where we stand tonight, we can now see the shimmering rays of light that signal the dawn of the 21st century.
That's what I want to talk with you about tonight. The future and the values that will shape it.
Plus more goddamn nonsense than ever.
Listen, what I'd like to know is how do I allow myself to get mixed up into these things?
The lessons of the past are ignored and obliterated.
Wherever we looked, the world was changing so fast that nothing of importance seemed to be happening.
The aim of the game is to feel real good. The aim of the game is to feel real good.
Today, the American people have spoken.
They have affirmed our course. They have told us to go forward.
Engage.
Engage to where, sir?
Hail Starfleet Command.
No response on standard frequencies. Curious. I am picking up a multitude of narrowband EM signals.
Let's hear.
A 747 jetliner is missing over the ocean off the bridges.
Holy cow!
Hello, Dan Bill Clinton. Did he change that just say no slogan to just say no?
It's a stupid idea.
No one's gonna go for it. Don't you understand? It's stupid. It's stupid.
Michael Jackson is claiming he impregnated a woman.
In a stunning upset, the new WBA heavyweight champion of the world.
I just saw a plane crash.
Okay, where at?
Well, it looked like it just took off the air.
We are here for you guys because we are fighting on the storm of events.
As long as we're together, time can't touch us.
The baby's name is Lourdes Maria.
Where are we?
The question isn't where we are. It's when we are.
According to astrometric readings, the year is 1996.
And now, a shortcut through 1996.
And here we are on our countdown to the apocalypse.
The Macarena.
It was actually kind of fun.
It's incredible.
We all stood at the brink of disaster, and most of us decided to go ahead and jump in.
All you have to do is jump to the side. That is the most complicated part of Macarena.
And it took me two extra jumps than I wanted to, but it happened.
We didn't work.
Just a taste of why you should tune in next Tuesday on Democracy Now! For Peter Beauchesne's Shortcut Through 1996. And if you want to be a part of it and share your thoughts on 1996, the best and worst of 1996, give us a call and we'll record your answer on our comment line and maybe you'll get in there too. Our number is 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. And while we're at it, Monday on Democracy Now!, a special tribute to Yip Harburg. His name may not be familiar to you, but I bet his songs are, like Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?, The Wizard of Oz, and Finian's Rainbow. That's coming up on Monday on Democracy Now! But right now, we're going to turn to something that's happening on Sunday down in Guatemala. And that is the signing of the Guatemala Peace Accords. 40 years ago, the United Fruit Company, with the Eisenhower administration's CIA, engineered a bloody coup d'etat against the democratically elected government of Guatemala. The coup unleashed one of the most brutal military regimes in the hemisphere. Some 140,000 people have been killed and a further 45,000 disappeared. In 1982 alone, more than 400 villages were wiped out in a U.S.-backed scorched earth campaign. The abuses were so horrific that even a horrified Amnesty International reported that they strained credulity. But next week, the guerrillas of the Guatemala National Revolutionary Unity, or URNG, will pen a controversial peace accord with the government and formally end some 40 years of war. Our guests to talk about this accord are Frank LaRue, the director of the Center for Human Rights Legal Action, a Guatemalan-based human rights group. He was in exile for 12 years during the 1980s and early 1990s and only recently returned to Guatemala. He is a Guatemalan labor lawyer. We're also joined by Jennifer Harberry, a lawyer and the wife of Comandante Everardo, one of the leading Mayan rebel leaders. Her international campaign to find out what happened to her husband after he was captured by the Guatemalan military has highlighted the situation of the tens of thousands disappeared by the regime. Her campaign also led to revelations that the CIA was behind her husband's murder and the murder of an American innkeeper named Michael Devine. Well, why don't we begin with Frank LaRue? Let me get first just your description of what is included in this Guatemalan peace accord.
Well, there's a series of accords that have been signed throughout the years. The negotiation between the government.
We're just having a little sound problem. Maybe we can put the right mic up there. Are you there, Frank?
I'm here.
Good. Why don't you start again?
The Guatemala peace process actually began in 1991 with the Mexico Accord that was signed in April in Mexico City. It went on and off for a while precisely because they were negotiating the topic of human rights, and the Guatemala military was strongly opposed to recognizing the abuses of the past or to putting limits to their power in the present. And the peace process was basically halted all the way till 1993. When there was a coup attempt, a self-inflicted coup by President Jorge Serrano. He wanted to do something similar to what Fujimori did in Peru. In the case of Guatemala, though, this failed, and he was ousted within a week, and there was an interim government of Ramiro de León who reinitiated the peace process, which began in January 1994. Actually, the Guatemala peace process was very much linked to international events like the Zapatista uprising in Mexico and the signing of NAFTA. There was an enormous international pressure coming from Mexico, the U.S., Canada, and the European countries to renew negotiations in Guatemala, and they kind of forced the military to agree on discussing human rights and sitting down at the table and signing an agreement. And it was the global agreement on human rights that the negotiation began again.
Well, Frank LaRue, this whole civil war obviously started after the overthrow of Arbenz, when land redistribution had been attempted by him. Now today we find that 2% of the Guatemalan population controls 70% of the land. What in this peace accord is going to change this fundamental issue of the land the land redistribution that is necessary?
That is essentially one of the critiques we have of the entire peace process. I believe that the armed conflict in Guatemala began primarily for the narrowing of political space. I mean, anyone who had a dissenting opinion was murdered in Guatemala or disappeared. I think it was the opening of political space what people were fighting for primarily. But I agree with you that the second most pressing problem in the country is land and socioeconomic problems. And in terms of land, I could say that in the last 30 years, the 36 years that the conflict has lasted, the land situation has gotten worse. We have now a higher degree of accumulation of land, primarily because some of the higher-ranking officers in the military, the generals and some of the colonels, began taking land by force from the Mayan indigenous communities in the highlands. So the tragedy of signing peace on the 29th of December, this coming Sunday, is that it does not seriously address at all the land question as an economic problem or the usurpations and takeover of land by the military.
We're talking to Guatemalan labor lawyer Frank LaRue, who is in Washington and not in Guatemala for the signing of the peace accord that'll be taking place on Sunday. Maybe that's an indication of his feelings about it. We'll find out in a minute, and we'll be joined by Jennifer Harbury. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now!, and we're talking about the Guatemalan Peace Accord that's going to be signed on Sunday. We're joined by labor lawyer Frank LaRue from Guatemala, who has not spent much of the last two decades in Guatemala, as he has been in exile here. And we're also joined on the telephone by Jennifer Harbury. And just before we go to Jennifer, Frank, I wanted you just to outline specifically what this peace accord accomplishes. What is in this peace accord?
Well, the peace accord is basically the sort of redrafting of all the different small agreements that they have signed since 1991. I would say in bringing them all together that the biggest achievement of the peace accords is the broadening of political space. There is a transition in Guatemala to a more democratic space. But aside from that, I think that little else has been gained. The military is still very powerful, and it is the most powerful institution. They still have veto power in politics. And the socioeconomic structure, including land, has not been altered at all.
So why did the rebels agree to it? Why did the guerrillas go along?
I think that there's two reasons. I mean, one is that Guatemala, as most of the countries, has undergone sort of a series of changes due to the globalization of the economy. And Guatemala is a country in transition where everyone agreed that the internal conflict could not continue if Guatemala was going to survive in the 21st century. And I think this was sort of a common consensus from all sides of the conflict in the country. There was clearly no way for the insurgent movement, for the URNG, to win the war, but it was clearly no way for the military to defeat them entirely, to get rid of them. So it was clear that both sides had to come down at the table of negotiations and sit down and draft an agreement. But more importantly, in Guatemala, the internal conditions, I think, are that for many years, there, 36 years, as a matter of fact, the insurgent movement had been sort of strong and with popular support. But I think people were getting tired of the conflict. And in Guatemala, you could see very clearly how the population was demanding peace. Civil society was demanding peace from both sides of the conflict. And I think both sides understood that this could not continue any longer.
Now, the accords will include, as I understand it, some level of not only demobilization by the guerrillas, but also of the army, a reduction in the size of the army. Is that correct? Or?
Yes, a third of the army. The army agreed on sort of getting rid of 33% of their forces.
And also included in this, and something that has turned even those who have been somewhat supportive of the peace accord have created a great deal of outrage, is the amnesty that was announced last week. We're joined by Frank LaRue and Jennifer Harberry. Her husband, Everardo, the last at the time surviving Mayan commandante of the guerrillas, was killed, we believe, in 1992, was it, Jennifer?
It's believed that he was killed in 1992. Some of the documents that I've received more recently suggest that he might have been alive for substantially longer than that.
Well, he was killed by Guatemalan military, who it now has become clear through a series of events, and because Jennifer went on a series of hunger fasts that forced the issue, it's now become clear that the CIA was involved with supporting those that killed her husband. How do you feel about this amnesty, and what do you understand this amnesty to cover?
Well, the amnesty, unfortunately, should have been more clearly drafted, and I think that's a lot of the cause of the different things that we're hearing right now. It's very clear that it's very specific that it does not cover genocide, torture, and forced disappearances. And it certainly looks like extrajudicial execution can be, you know, brought into a different clause that's in, you know, that act that was passed by the Congress pursuant to the signing of the peace accords. Unfortunately, it's vaguely drafted, which means that when the cases go to the courts, there's going to be a lot of problems backing and forthing as to whether or not certain types of crimes there were simply gross human rights violations by the army are covered or not, and that, of course, is negative. And we're just going to have to, as the international community, link arms and insist that the peace accords on that issue be very, very strictly construed, as we must insist, by the way, on all of those parts of the peace accords which are not vague. And by that, I would cite the example of the human rights accord that was signed in March of 1994, which prohibited the Army from continuing the human rights violations that it had committed all along. That legally went into effect forthwith. And the next week, they literally, very literally, shot a judge and a congressman. And I would note for the record that since September, even of this year, even as the war closed down, that two members of CONIC, indigenous leaders, were machine-gunned in their car. Three people in the Defensoria Maya were assassinated. A young man whose father is a leader in the GOM has been picked up twice and beaten severely and threatened with death. The man that used to edit the InfoPress has been assassinated. A union leader was assassinated. Several have been beaten. This is all just this fall.
Well, this leads to a question that I've had for a while, yeah. And that is that this peace accord signing, which supposedly ends the war wasn't the reason for most of the killing, considering the killing was done mainly by the military and paramilitary. So what does this do about that?
Okay, that is the great issue. A peace accord has been signed, which can give space for everybody to go back to doing the social economic reforms that they were trying to do in the late 70s and the early 80s. Equality for the indigenous people, the equivalent of NAACP movements, for example, land reform, union efforts, efforts to gain a minimum wage that would feed their children. A minimum wage in Guatemala very literally doesn't cover basic dietary needs. Efforts to form co-ops, literacy campaigns, rural health campaigns, et cetera, et cetera. Under the peace accords, the door is now open to go back to that and hopefully not be wiped out as they were in the late 70s and early 80s. And the real issue is, will these peace accords be treated by the army and by the international community as if they were just a piece of paper without any meaning whatsoever? Was it just a joke to get Guatemala into NAFTA? And that's where I would certainly call on the international community to this time step forward and really insist that these peace accords be given weight.
Well, what is the difference between the Truth Commission that might be set up under these accords and those that were developed, let's say, in Argentina, or South Africa, El Salvador, or other places where there have been big civil conflicts?
I'm not familiar with the South. I mean, I know of the South African and Argentine Truth Commissions and stuff. I'm not familiar with the details of how they worked on stuff. The way this Truth Commission will work is there will be an intensive study of the different cases and the evidence. Names cannot be named. They can only say whether the Army did it or whether it was done by a different sector of the society. So that actual names will not be used. In that peace accord initially, there was to be no amnesty at all. That was the give and take on that peace accord back in 1994, and that's one of the disturbing facets of this most recent amnesty accord.
Frank LaRue, why was this amnesty signed? It seems to be more encompassing than any we've seen in any other country.
It sure is. I agree with Jennifer that we'll have to try to bring cases to court and try to insist on sort of a positive interpretation of the law. But the fact of the matter is that this law is very vaguely written, and we believe that's on purpose. I mean, you can't be signing peace of 30-year conflict and say that by mistake, things were not very clear. I think they were left very broadly and vaguely, precisely to allow some maneuvering. It's going to be our pressure in Guatemala and the international community's pressure was just going to make this law applied in a more narrow focus. But I would say that the biggest problem in Guatemala at this moment was the last few accords that were signed, including this amnesty one and the socioeconomic one, is that during this government, Arzu government, which was just inaugurated in January, there was a concerted effort to hasten the process. The negotiating process had been lasting for quite a while, since 1991, and for over 5 years. And I think both parties would see the benefit of accelerating the timetables. For the URNG was to reinsert themselves politically in a faster period, but for the government primarily it was a way of doing fundraising with the international community. The problem is that every time that the process has been hastened, every time people accelerate the negotiations, the substance of those accords is being affected. I think they went so fast that some of the major issues were not dealt with appropriately, and more importantly, civil society in Guatemala was not really consulted. I mean, there was no serious process of consultation. So the peace process became more and more isolated from the dynamic of society as a whole, and basically an agreement between two parties that were negotiating in Mexico away from the dynamics of society in the country.
There are some who say that this peace accord really is not very important. It's not really going to change things, and we shouldn't pay much attention to it. It's not going to make a significant difference in Guatemala. Do you agree with that, Frank LaRue?
I think there's two ways of looking at it. I think that peace accords, and looking not only at Guatemala but at El Salvador and other countries, actually achieve much less than the expectations of the population. Clearly, there has been no change in the socioeconomic structure. I think the socioeconomic accord is one of the weak ones. I would say there's basically several good accords, the Human Rights Accord, the Indigenous Rights Accord, the reinsertion of displaced population. All those are actually good accords. The weak ones are basically the Truth Commission, the socioeconomic, and now the amnesty one. And
why no name calling? Why? Well, I mean, it's pretty standard, I know, around the world with these truth commissions, but it seems to me if you don't name names, then people go on and they do this kind of thing if they're not personally responsible.
Yeah, and it's not exactly pretty standard. I think that was the case in Chile, but truth commissions, as human rights legislation around the world, improve with every example. So the truth commission in Chile was much broader than that in Argentina, for instance, but the one in El Salvador was much broader than the ones before, and in El Salvador, clearly, names were named. Obviously, a truth commission cannot deal with the entire bulk of cases, but those that they deal with, those that are brought to their attention, are investigated thoroughly and then the names are brought out. I think that one of the weaknesses of this accord is precisely to avoid that. And for us, when we say it very clearly, is half the truth is not the truth. So if you can't say, for instance, who were the military officers that walked into a village and murdered 300 people, including babies and women and children and elderly, then justice has not been done. Even history has not been rewritten. One of the problems in Guatemala is that all these events are kept in silence because the remote areas, and this is indigenous population, anonymous indigenous sort of victims. And one of the big efforts we have to do in order to achieve some degree of transition in Guatemala is to bring about truth and to bring all the truth of everything that happened.
Usually when an accord is reached in some third world country that ends a civil conflict, the United States accompanies it with promises of new economic aid. Of course, rarely is the aid ever forthcoming, as in Nicaragua or Haiti or other places. Have there been any promises on the part of the Clinton administration or any other international bodies to economic assistance to help Guatemala through its transition to democracy here?
There has been some promises, I mean, in terms of amounts of aid. But what's interesting is that in the case of Guatemala, what we have been hearing for the last 2 years is everyone saying, look, there's not going to be any money. I mean, basically, peace is coming to Guatemala in a different period of time. There's a restriction of budget of foreign assistance, so don't count on anything. So no one has said specifically the amount of aid that U.S. will give. But in any case, it won't be over $50 million. So if you consider what this country has gone through, the tragedy in human value and the socioeconomic tragedy of 36 years of conflict, the international assistance that is being talked about is pitiful, really. I mean, I think that obviously countries and developed countries spend more money in war efforts and during the Cold War than they're now willing to spend for peace and reconstruction.
So in essence, the United States and the CIA are taking no responsibility for their involvement and their authorship in this conflict.
Well, I think it's even worse than that, in that I've been hearing that there's been rumblings from different executive branches to the congressional people that perhaps now that peace has come, there should be a resumption of normal military aid, whereas I've heard nothing about the millions and millions of dollars we spent destroying the country and leaving, you know, hundreds of thousands of orphans struggling to survive in the streets. I've heard nothing about setting up scholarships for them or rebuilding the country. I think it's even worse than not just being very generous.
In the States, for instance, one of the things that baffles me when I come back to Washington, and especially seeing the debate with the CIA and other agencies today, is that there is no serious recognition of the past. We're talking about the Truth Commission in Guatemala, and I'm bringing about the truth of what happened. And this is a Truth Commission that's supposed to investigate 30 years of conflict on both sides, and I think that's the way to do it. I think truth has to be across the board. But clearly, I think telling the entire truth is very important, and the truth always, as we well know, and a lot of information has come out, for instance, in the struggle that Jennifer has done, is that events in Guatemala are very closely linked to events in Washington and to decisions being made here. I wonder whether there would be the same effort to bring about truth here. I mean, when there has been disclosures of CIA activity or U.S. involvement, people like to brush them off. One is an event of the past. 1954 happened so long ago that why should there be any sort of collective responsibility in terms of foreign policy? But the other issue is that there's still an attempt to silence people. I mean, when Rick Nucci, for instance, of the State Department, gave information to Congressman Torricelli, then this whole scandal breaks out and the CIA wants to clamp down and close the doors to any further information.
And they censored him. I mean, they censured him by taking away his top security clearance. Jennifer Harbury, how do you feel about that? The man who made it clear, finally, to you, who was involved with your husband's slaying?
I'm completely outraged, and I think, you know, certainly Mr. Nucci should be seeing a civil rights attorney at this point, in that, you know, I don't understand how it's possible that the United States government would actually punish someone who is exposing corruption and an illegal course of conduct by the U.S. government itself. I mean, theoretically, at least, we have an absolute prohibition on that, you know, through our Constitution. Any kind of secret government action is prohibited, and retaliation against whistleblowers is also prohibited. They, of course, are arguing that, you know, giving away information that could, you know, endanger an asset is completely prohibited as well. But we cannot have people covering up for illegal activities, especially when it's as serious an event or course of conduct as torture and assassination.
How do you feel, Jennifer, that there will not be names named, at least as a result of the Truth Commission, either of the military officers involved in your husband's killing, not to mention the many others you have crusaded for in Guatemala, mm-hmm. not only the Guatemalan military, but the U.S. CIA and the agents there and the going up to the highest level of the U.S. CIA involved with killings in Guatemala?
I'm very disappointed, of course, that the Truth Commission will not name them, but my reaction is what I think is the reaction of many, many people. If the Truth Commission won't name them, I will. And I think that's going to be a very, very critical role for us to play here in the United States in solidarity with the people of Guatemala. We've got to get those files declassified because they do have the names. And then we can put up a monument, you know, that will really pay tribute to the people who were slaughtered in Guatemala all these years. And I think that's a very, very important role that we're going to have to play. You had asked me earlier, by the way, about the comparative nature of the Truth Commissions. And, for example, in Salvador.
We just have about 20 seconds.
In Salvador, for example, there was an amnesty so that they weren't worried about the prosecution of people whose names were named. And I think, you know, we've got to get a point in Latin America history where people will be named and prosecuted.
On that note, we want to thank you both very much for joining us. Jennifer Harbury, who lost her husband in Guatemala, killed by Guatemalan military on the payroll of the CIA, and Frank LaRue, a Guatemalan labor lawyer, as they reflect on the Guatemalan peace accords to be signed on Sunday. Well, that does it for us, Juan. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, Julie Drizin, and Errol Maitland. Errol Maitland, also our engineer. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Nine minutes, 15 seconds.